Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us from wherever you are in the world for this third and final day of Cool Logistics Global 2020 first virtual edition. My name is Rachel White, and on behalf of the whole Cool Logistics team, I want to thank everybody again for taking time to join us and be with us in this virtual environment. I'm going to give a few housekeeping notes to open the day, with apologies for repetition for those who've already joined us, but just to keep informed the people who are joining us fresh today. So first, how to get the most of this virtual event. If you haven't already, please do download our mobile app. That's where you'll find most of the content to help you make the most of your time during this virtual event. You'll be able to see agenda, speakers, the network, who else is in the room, make contact with people, request meetings, see what's going on and what people are saying about the event, take part in polls. Please do take time. We're polling opinions, and there's a polling button with a number of polls open, and see the list of all our sponsors and exhibitors, without whom this event wouldn't be possible. On the top right hand of your app, there's a sponsors exhibitors button, and if you go in there, you can visit the virtual exhibition and see, as you can see hopefully on the slide below you, the very large range of companies from many different segments of the global cold supply chain who've supported us this year. Many of them are in the conference and have actively taken part. I have the great pleasure of also announcing the winner of our leaderboard for the highest level of activity and engagement for day two of the conference, as Manoj Nair. Manoj, congratulations, and you have a free conference ticket to the next Cool Logistics. Thank you also to John Trenchard, who's coming in second, who was the winner of our first day's leaderboard, and of course to Andy Cannell, third placed. So it's great to see such a high level of engagement from the audience with our speakers and with each other during the event. Please today keep on sharing information, talking with each other, making comments, and giving us your feedback. And on the matter of feedback, there's also a button on your mobile app and on the desktop event platform for rates and reviews. We'd really appreciate your feedback on the different sessions, what you thought of them, because that's going to help us shape conferences going forwards to make sure you're getting value and the type of information you need. So today we have a whole day focused on cold chain infrastructure, nodes and modes to market. When we were thinking about setting up this conference and how we should run it this year, we're aware that many years past in Cool Logistics, we've always had fantastic debates, but we've often been focused on individual nodes, particularly, of course, the reefer shipping node, so important to the global perishables trade. But what I've been aware of the last few days is how much the conversation is actively shifting to a much more holistic, whole perspective on how do we make this cold chain work and ensure that goods can get to market. So today, what we're going to be looking at is a more holistic cold chain perspective, covering modes and nodes with case studies and views from many different regions. Before we go into our first session, and I have the pleasure to welcome back dear friends from many years, just want to tender some apologies. We know that those of you who were in the session at the end of yesterday, we had a rather abrupt cutoff. The tech booted us out, so to speak, and we do apologise because we know the debate was quite lively at the point we had to swiftly exit. That has been rectified and it won't be happening again today. I'd also like to confirm that we have a new session. We've added a new session to close the day at 4 o'clock BST, for those of you who are still with us. We've been running networking sessions and networking lunch where all the delegates can come online and chat with each other, video conference with each other, and that's been really successful. And we wanted to add an extra opportunity for delegates to come online and just generally sort of talk with each other, reflect on the conference at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So we hope you'll join us for a lively closing discussion. Immediately after that, at 5 p.m. BST, we are very pleased to announce that we have a virtual meeting of the London Maritime Mystery Martini Club, more commonly referred to as LMC3. It's an informal group run by Steve Cameron, who you may have seen moderating sessions on day three. And we'd like to thank Steve very much for joining us to host one of these meetings at 5 o'clock. So please click through, join us for a virtual martini or drink of your choice and some lively conversation within the community at 5 o'clock. And Steve will be coming online shortly before lunch just to say a few words about what is LMC3 and welcome you to join him this evening. Please also, and you can do this either via your desktop app or via the mobile app, interact with us during the day, ask questions and make comments. It's so important that we have a whole flow of dialogue between all of us. And we've really been pleased and thankful for all the many questions that have come in to inform the debate over the last few days. So don't forget to make your voice heard during the event. I think that's all I need to say at the moment, but we'll be back during the day with more housekeeping. Please don't forget also that on your app, we have a how-to with little videos to help you navigate your way around the event. And we have a help desk because we appreciate that everyone's dialing in with their own technology and can encounter some issues. So don't forget to tap into those if you have any problems at all. So, moving on to introduce our first session of the day. I was thinking back over the last couple of days and hearing the news overnight of a new fresh lockdown curfew announced by President Macron in France, the news that the UK is probably going in the same way and other nations are experiencing a second wave. What we can say is, you know, this isn't done yet. So under our theme for the event of Imagine, Transform and Rebuild, you know, the global pandemic is still very much with us. And the impact of that on running cold chains is still very much something that the industry is going to need to grapple with for some time to come. One of the things here is how do we run the ports, the cold stores, the rail, the trucking, and the other associated infrastructure that make cold chains work. So we can say rebuild, but there's also an aspect of build. You know, how do we create the infrastructure that's going to run the cold chains of the future? And how do we merge the physical and the digital to use new technology to enhance the performance of critical infrastructure? So that's where we're going to be going today and what we're going to be talking about, both the physical infrastructure and the digital world to inform how that infrastructure can perform to maximum capability. I was reminded when talking with the speakers of our first session of a quote from Professor Calestous Juma, Harvard Emeritus and specialist in African economies for many decades. And he said, infrastructure is both the backbone for the economy, but also the motherboard for technological innovation. I think that's something we'd like to talk about today. So without further ado, I'm going to kick us off with our first session now. Really pleased and delighted to welcome back Alfred Chung, who's reminded us this morning that he's been a speaker at every single Cool Logistics. So thank you and welcome, Alfred. Professor Dr. Marco Thiemann, specialist in halal, who previously spoke with us. So it's great to have him back. And Sophie Tolk, who also has joined us at so many events, speaking first from the Port of Rotterdam and now from Sohar. So our first session is focusing on Asia and the Middle East and the global world of halal. And I'm super excited for this discussion and hope you are going to enjoy it. Without further ado, I would like please to ask Alfred to take the floor and give us a view on reefer on rail in Japan and on e-commerce. Alfred, floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a great pleasure to be here again after so many years, 12 years. All the time I've been with Cool Logistics Global. And thanks to the whole team, including yourself, and then your closely connected colleague, Alex, and also to Annalise, Holly, and then Anne, and then Helen, and many others. And of course, many thanks to the sponsors, the media, and also industry support. So just the word for the opening. And I have to say, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all the friends around the world. And I skip the wording of ladies and gentlemen, because right now we better say all friends. Okay, now without going into further into this kind of introducing myself, actually I'm a professor teaching at the university and also doing some consultants for the cold chain logistics. And this time actually is a real case about the Japan reefer on rail life case, which is seeing is believing, and I'm going to tell you the truth. And again, it will give you some kind of insight about what will be the future of the new reefer technology and the reefer box is going to be in Asia as well as other part of the world. And again, after that, we have to talk about a little bit about this COVID-19. Actually having a great impact onto our lives. And right now we have the new normal, we call it WFH, work from home, work from home, and also we have a so-called the home delivery and all these kind of things, and we'll go to that part a little bit later. Now, without further delay, I'm going to start with first slide. Now, I'm going to talk about four major topics today. Basically, it's about the impact of refrigeration technology on the cold chain management, which is actually, we have all kinds of so-called reefer technology, including the temperature control, the atmospheric control, and so on and so forth. But right now, we have something new, which is making use of high voltage electrostatic application. We will come to that in more details in the following slides. And then we are going to touch on the new reefer technology in the Japan reefer on rail and how they do the operation. And this is the government subsidized project. And I think they are looking for the so-called new type of energy and in order to reduce carbon dioxide and as well as the future, so-called making use of the battery or even solar energy to start with something and basically on the cool logistics. And then we are going to show you the pilot result of the Shokan container. Shokan container is the name given to the new reefer on rail boxes that are right now in running and in testing period in Japan. And Shokan is Japanese actually. In English, this is the ice feeling of the ice. So this is the thing that we're going to tell you the result and how it works and whether it is really something that you may think would be a kind of alternate or kind of options for the future reefer boxes. And then the last topic we're going to touch is about the new normal under COVID-19. As I mentioned, is work from home and also the changing pattern of the last mile delivery. Actually, before that, we are talking about B2B, B2C, and so on and so forth. But right now, actually, the last mile become maybe a last kilo. And then moving things from the restaurant to home. And these are the things making huge so-called impact onto the reefer logistics and cold chain management. So this is basically the topic I'm going to talk about today. It will last about, say, 15 to 30 minutes at the most. Actually, I only give you the PDF file, but in fact, the original file is with lots of animation, but right now, just to make it very simple. So we're going to talk about the impact of new river refrigeration technology on the cold chain management and see how it works. And then we'll come to see things like this. Now, of course, everybody should be understanding, temperature is one of the most important things to keep things fresh and also in the cold chain management. So most of the river boxes, basically is focusing on the temperature control. So this, you can set the temperature, from minus 40 or even to minus 60 for the super river, down to plus 30, depending on the purpose and also depending on the cargo you're going to carry and also your focus on the segment in the river business sector. And then we, of course, will come to the temperature control. We talk about the FAE and we talk about super river, which is, I'm not going to talk about the details because it is not to be covered in this presentation. And then the other one is on the atmospheric control, basically the control atmosphere, modified atmosphere, as well as the AFM or AFM plus. So these are actually the control of the atmospheric content inside the river boxes. And so these are the mainstreams right now in the so-called river box and river technology nowadays. But right now we have something newer and making use of the electronic field technology, which is basically electrostatic way of handling together with the temperature control, of course. And the temperature control is, the range may not be that great from minus 60 to plus 30, but it will be roughly about minus 15 to plus 5 to 7, something around that. And basically, there are two types. One is called the Shokan, which is ice filling, as I mentioned earlier. And the other one is damp up. Basically, the idea and the technology behind is more or less the same. They are making use of the electrostatic fields and applying the temperature. The temperature control together with the electrostatic fields. So these are the things I'm going to focus today on, this Shokan, the ice fitting boxes. Basically, this is the testing actually being handled by Japan rail cargo. Now we come down to a little bit explanation on the Shokan ice technology. Maybe you understand that, or maybe it's something very new to you. Basically, water molecule will be frozen at 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit. But once it has been frozen, you can see all the molecules sticking together. And you have it defrosted, and then the molecule membrane will be broken. And that's why for fish or meat, and after defrost, you may have something, the dripping, and then also the blood or as well as other juice coming out. So the inside, the ordinary freezer, basically you only have the so-called super chilling and then cooling in order to actually suppress this kind of so-called damage to the membrane of the molecule of water content or the liquid or the so-called the mushroom molecules inside. But for the ice throwing or the Shokan technology, basically applying the high temp voltage, all the molecules will be staying apart from each other, so that even though at the freezing temperature minus 0 or minus or below, then they are not sticking together. So by the time it returns to normal temperature, you don't see that kind of so-called the breaking or the damage of the membrane. And this is right now one of the very interesting technology is coming on, and as well as keeping the so-called vegetables and then meat and then dairy products in a very new way. And also you can see the freshness is very, very important. In Japan, we talk about so-called sashimi, and then which is, the freshness is the most important part. If you don't have that kind of freshness, basically you can't sell it at a price that you are looking for. Now, so the new type of missile on the reform operation in Japan, and we're going to show you how it's going to work, and then what are the actual operation, what are projects going on. So these are the things we're going to take a look at. Now, you can see the actual photo of the Jokan container, which is about 12 feet, which is just 120 foot of the regular river, but it is being put onto the rail. And actually, you can use the train forklift to do that. And what are the important things about this so-called Jokan? And the ice training boxes, the important part is you have the battery actually built into the box. The battery, you have the two big battery actually housed at the bottom of the boxes. So that, in other ways, that it can move around without external power supply. And so that it is clean, and also it can move around, say, from truck to rail or on board a ship or domestic or whatsoever. And you can, you know, put it inside or outside the DC distribution center, and then it's still keeping temperature and keeping the condition of this so-called Jokan filling. And this is something very interesting, as well as when you are moving one place or another, and then you are having many, many third parties, and then you will be handling the boxes, and somehow someone will forget to power it or unplug it. In other rail operations in America and also at terminals, and these are some of the human errors we find somehow, somewhere, and it will cause a big damage. But here, because it's battery operation, basically you don't see this kind of problem at all. Now, why you say Japan is putting effort onto this kind of testing, because it is a government project and government subsidized project. And the focus actually here is based on three important things. The one is they're thinking about new way of storing and also moving around perishables, and also making this kind of river boxes, the Jokan river box. You can move around say the produce and then perishable from, say, from northern part of Hokkaido down to Okinawa. But Okinawa is not being linked by rail, but you have to do some connecting vessel from Kyushu to Okinawa. Still the box is on. So basically its coverage is the whole Japan. Even though part of that will be done by rail, done by shipping. And also, this is the important thing is we want to trim down and contribute to the carbon dioxide reduction, which is very, very important, as well as, because this kind of so-called new energy and then, approach will actually create many, many pieces of opportunity for others too. So again, this is one of the so-called things we're looking for, and then we will go into details and as this one become one of the very successful pilot studies. Now this is a very simple, and then basically we're telling you how to charge it, and then using so-called transformer, or actually you can use the R type of so-called three-phase type of generated charging. But basically, I think eventually it will come up with the ordinary power supply from household or from battery, from industry, from companies or from factories, the same thing. So basically, the charging can be done to the full batteries and then simultaneous. Now, actually, operation is very simple. Once the temperature is set, and then you can see there is a three mode. One is the station mode, the other one is the train mode, and the final one, the off, is simple enough. That means if you want to switch it on, and then the operation, it will be the train mode. And then station mode means that it will be not moving and then you'll be stationed somewhere, you know, in the railway station or in some of the depots or something else. So basically, operation is very simple, and then I think people without too much training can handle this kind of things. So these are basically you can see from front, sideways, and then on inside. Basically, it looks like sort of like a seagoing reefer container with the red line overall, and also there will be a switch that when the door is externally closed, there will be the alarm and so on and so forth. Basically, it is the same as the ordinary construction of a seagoing reefer container. Now, again, this is a little bit technical, but schematic diagram of the structure of the Q-Fan container. And you can see that the application is basically using the AC current at 100 volt, and then we generate the DC 360, actually even higher voltage, and sometimes the SI is 3000 something. But the current is very small, so basically it won't hurt you. You'll touch it. And again, the battery, you can see the battery 1 and 2 at the bottom side of the boxes. And again, you have something quite different from the other reefer container is the DC-DC so-called converter, as well as the power flux and things a little bit different from the seagoing containers. So I'm not going to go into detail on these kind of things, but basically this is the structure of the so-called Q-Fan container. If you need to know more the detail, you can email me and give me all the technical information, as well as we can have the Japan Rail Cargo, the South Kanto Logistic Company, to supply you with more information. So we'll show you again the test result of this Q-Fan container and then see whether it will be something like this. Now this is actually one of the pilot study, and then moving the fresh fish, we call salmon, which is right now very in season, very delicious, and also the crabs and so on. And you can move it along. It is actually by rail 42 hours from Hokkaido down to the central part of Japan, and then you find out the conditions actually just look like immediate after capture, and the taste is excellent. So these are the new way of handling reefers cargo. And again, I believe these are the things that we are going to have more and more opportunity in the days to come. Now, the Q-Fan container basically take care of two things. One is on freshness, and basically, as I mentioned, it will keep you as fresh as possible. The other one is on aging. The aging is actually, you say, for example, rice or, you know, or wheat or other things. And then if you keep in the temperature control storeroom, yes, it will stay there. But basically, in the Q-Fan container, it will keep you also something very good for the aging process. And then the rice will become more delicious to eat. And these are the things going on. And then we're going to explore that in more detail in the days to come. And again, you can see basically the difference between the ordinary refrigeration and all the Q-Fan technology. And there is one I'm missing over the Q-Fan content here. Sorry for that. And then you can see the little bowls that actually, even though after 10 days, still maintain the condition. And tuna, you can see the difference in color. And for the asparagus and strawberry, which is very important and basically moving a large quantity. And you can see if you have domestic moving, particularly for Japan, which is very long with many islands and then covering a different temperature zone. And these are things that will help you to get the better value of the cargo. And then I think right now we have quickly covered the so-called Q-Fan technology. I know that there will be lots of more information maybe you want to know, but during the time period, I'm going to stop over there and then I'll give you a new normal under COVID-19, which is very, very important, you know, for the time being. as well as we are all suffering. And then we hope that we can work something different and then help to rebuild the economy. So right now, the new normal is work from home. And also the changing pattern of the last month. And you can see that this is what we call building up the digital economy. We have the Internet of Things and then and the AI, and also we have the ICT, the information and communication technology. And then coming up, we do a digital transformation, DX. So all this kind of thing, AI, IoT, ICT, will fit into this kind of so-called digital transformation for all our company and all our daily life. And then what is that? FinTech, blockchain. And then you can see that we can supply chain management, demand chain management. And this one is cross-border income, which is growing to be something great. And everybody's buying things, selling things over the net. And again, you have the matching business, and you have the many platforms. Like for some, this is one of the platforms you can have meetings and platform, other platform for cold chain, cold storage, and so on and so forth. And also online. And you can see yesterday, Ozempic is one of the lines they're coming up over, and then as well as many other lines, like shipping lines, and as well as government. Now, this will give you what is going on. You have the changing preference of value because people are buying, they don't have this, and then looking for faster and even quicker delivery of the shipments, and then they drive everybody crazy about that. So the delivery man is yelling all the time. And then the rise of experimental retail, they're reminding you that you have to buy the vitamin and so on and so forth. And so this is subscription and e-commerce. And then you have the so-called on-channels, and then so many things, Twitter, Facebook, and as well as other things coming up. So what is coming to get into things is called, we call the new normals. And then we work from home. And then we will see that again, the takeout becomes something very important. Then every restaurant, every big so-called bakery, they say, oh, welcome, takeout, and then your home delivery, and so on and so on. So this is what we call work from home, and then last mile delivery becomes such a great thing. And again, you can see the last mile delivery. Now, these are very famous names. You know or you may not know. But you can say the Uber Eats, and then Panda, and then Food Delivery, and so on and so forth. Basically, you can see in Japan in particular, and all the bicycles and the bikes are moving around with black box of Uber Eats, and also going up the Food Panda, as well as different names in your region in a different part of the world. So basically, this is changing the last mile delivery very much. Basically, it's only, say, a few kilos, you know, from the actually from bakery or from the central kitchen to your home. So that's all. And then I hope you enjoy it. And then thank you for listening. And thank you very much.
Alfred, thank you very much. Japanese innovation and ingenuity for maximizing opportunity for cold chain on rail. And a very big topic at the end in terms of last mile delivery and e-commerce. We were discussing this yesterday, that there's a big shift in the work from home environment where people are thinking more deeply about food and looking for freshness. Yeah. So, and this was on the cards in when we were talking yesterday. So something we might be able to get back into. But without further ado, I'm going to reserve questions to the end so we can have a bit of a debate and chat. I would like to hand over and introduce Professor Dr. Marco Tiemann to give us a view on, I'm very excited about this, the emergence of the halal market and what it means for halal port cold chain infrastructure. Marco, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel, for your introduction. First of all, a very good morning, a very good afternoon, and for the Pacifics, a very good evening already. It's a great honor to be invited at Cool Logistics to talk about the halal port. I've been 15 years active on halal logistics and supply chain management, advisor to governments, private sector, but also As a researcher, I've been doing my PhD on halal supply chain and have been continuing doing research on halal supply chains and even what Alfred talks about, blockchain technology, which is coming up. And I've also been doing research on the halal blockchain. So very exciting. I hope to give you a better understanding of the halal industry and its dynamics. And also share with you some external developments in the halal ports and logistics. So I will be talking about the evolution of halal, what is a halal port, some case studies in Indonesia, Malaysia, and also in Europe, which are very interesting. And then some conclusions, some takeaways, I think, for all of you here listening to my talk. So first of all, the evolution of halal. Well, halal has to do with Islam, with the religion of Islam. And as we have many Muslims in the world, halal has become a very big industry. We're not only talking about meat, not only talking about food. We talk about cosmetics, pharmaceuticals, but also chemicals. I thought I was a halal expert, but I'm surprised every year on new kinds of products and categories that they were managed to get it halal certified. So I've seen fridges being halal certified, toilet paper being halal certified, cat food. So it is a fast expanding industry. It is multi-trillion in value, and in various sectors, it's growing double digit. And as we are now all going into the COVID crisis, there are not so many industries that are double digits still in growth. And the halal industry is definitely one of them. So halal is not static, it's going through an evolution from an initial stage where a Muslim was buying from another Muslim and he trusted that the Muslim was the seller was a Muslim, so therefore everything he produces is halal. The second stage, where a lot of countries, they have a halal certification body, where the halal product or service is halal certified, is verified by the halal certification body that the ingredients as well as the production process are halal. What we now move towards is stage C, the halal supply chain, where not only the source need to be halal, but the entire supply chain. So similar to a cool chain, you don't want to have any breakage in the supply chain. The integrity of a cool chain is as strong as its weakest link. The same is true for halal. The fourth stage, which is still future music, is the halal value chain, where you also address other components such as Islamic banking and finance, sustainability, Islamic branding and marketing, and also had a transition from meat-based to plant-based. So you can address that evolution as a stage of a country, but also you can address that as a maturity for a company and address at what stage am I as a brand owner. But I now would like to address what are the key trends. So next to food, we have seen a shift, food where it started, we see a shift to the non-food halal certification. Halal requires a supply chain approach, and we also see over the past years that ports and the logistics sector are moving into that in a big way. It was initially local companies, often in Muslim countries like in Malaysia and Indonesia, and now you see that the multinationals are also getting into the game of halal logistics. I would like to share now about the halal port. Why do we need a halal port? What is the value also for the shipping lines? So first of all, what I talked about is that halal supply chains, similar to cool chains, cannot be broken. The responsibility lies with the brand owner. So as Nestlé is halal certified, it is the responsibility of Nestlé to make sure that the halal supply chain is not broken anywhere. That also covers in transportation, storage. It is a fact that halal certification bodies have already in the standard a clause that halal needs to be segregated from non-halal in storage and transport, meaning that needs to be addressed. However, until today, halal authorities have not been enforcing this, have not been checking it, this. And with advanced technologies and with more advanced standards, this is something which is coming very fast. There's a lot of high competition in ports and shipping. So halal certification and offering halal services could provide you with a competitive advantage from competing ports or competing shipping lines. It also could mean you can earn extra income by developing services which you can charge for. It's also important to address for ports that are doing business with Muslim countries in the Middle East or in Asia to be well prepared. So it's also a matter of protecting your corporate reputation as a port or shipping line doing business with Islamic countries. Finally, we have seen that new halal standards are being developed. Malaysia and Indonesia are one of the pioneers in halal standards. You see that Turkey is leading a development of an international standard. UAE introduced the halal standards a few years ago. Kingdom of Saudi Arabia will be introducing a new halal standard very soon. So a lot of developments are driving towards the importance of halal ports and also halal certification for shipping lines. So what is a halal port? A halal port has a few important components, and I foremost addressed it from a terminal perspective. So first of all, you need to communicate the halal status of the cargo, and you do that through the words halal supply chain. You put that on freight documents, you communicate it in IT system, and if it's a full load of halal for a container, for example, they can also put a halal supply chain sticker on the container. Halal storage is extremely important at ports and terminals. So it's important that halal goods have a designated halal storage zone. Also, you cannot mix halal and non-halal vertically in storage. And finally, in cold rooms, you cannot mix halal with products in the same cold room that have porcine in there or pork based. Halal transport is important. Facilitating the sea freight supply chain. Where it's important to realize if the transport is destined for an Islamic country, for example, to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, that you cannot mix halal and non-halal products in that same container, tank or cargo hold. If you're sending a product to a non-Muslim country, there are certain leniencies in there where you can not mix on the same pallet or load carrier, but certain categories of non-halal products, like for example containing alcohol, are allowed, but the cool transport never mix with product that contain pork. Yeah. Livestock holding is also an aspect that can happen, imports of livestock in Muslim countries where you cannot mix halal and non-halal livestock. And cargo inspection. Traditionally, cargo inspection, they have one inspection room for veterinary services. Customs has its own place, but they have one table and one set of tools. So one time is pork, then it is halal, then it's pork, and they're using the same table, same tools. And different from a laboratory, inspection products go back into the container. So there is not being destroyed the sample. If you're going to halal cool transport in particular, when you have a container, how does it work, the halal cool transport process? So first of all, you need to allocate a specific cargo to a transport unit. And that unit, for example, a container, has to be properly cleaned. For Muslim markets in Asia, they are in the Shafi'i school of thought, it has to be ritual cleansed. Ritual cleansing is only practiced here where I am in Southeast Asia. It's not practiced in the Middle East, and it's not practiced in Africa. So that might not be relevant for all markets you're sending your container to. Then you have to look at loading, what can be put together with the halal cargo, and then labeling and coding. So these are the key processes for halal cool transport. I'm going too fast. So if you talk about halal certification, It's important to realize that halal assurance system is built on existing quality system. It does not replace your quality system. And it is just a certification which is much easier than an ISO system, which is referring to your actual ISO processes. You have more than 400 halal certification bodies in the world. So there's a lot of choice to get it certified for. In Muslim countries, Islamic countries, is often limited to one, which is often driven by the government. If you want to get halal certified, what are important steps in halal certification? There are three steps. First of all, you have to develop a halal strategy. So what is the business model that the products and services you're going to develop? What are your key markets and what technology are you going to use? And also, who are your partners in developing those halal shipping services or halal port services? It's not necessarily means that you have to do everything from A to Z. You can, for example, the ritual cleansing of the sea, of the containers can be done by a third party, as a good example. Then you have to develop a halal certification strategy. Who should certify us? And what should be certified exactly? So the scope of certification and the certification body. And there are local halal certification bodies and international certification bodies. And finally, in the halal strategy and commercial action plan, at the end, you want to create it as a service. So it should also make financial sense to go into this direction. And you should see halal services as a profit area where you can make new profits instead of a pure cost center. The second aspect is the operations model. So our consultants normally do an assessment of the operations, see if there are certain adjustment needs to be done in processes or even warehouse facility layout that you can do proper segregation between halal and non-halal, and develop the documentation. So similar to an ISO documentation, you also have to develop an halal assurance system documentation. And then implementation, so you train the people, get your operations ready, and then you need to practice the operation for 3 months in order to get track record, and then you can invite the halal certification board to review your halal operations and then for certification. There are many halal certification bodies in the world and also many different types of lead times. So some halal authorities are quicker than others. So it's good to get help on this, who's the best halal certification body to use. Now I would like to share with you some exciting case studies. I would like to share with you some examples, what is happening in Malaysia, what is happening in Indonesia and also in Europe. I've been very privileged to work for Johor Port Authority. Johor Port Authority is part of the Ministry of Transport in Malaysia. Johor Port Authority is a so-called landlord port, so they develop the main infrastructure. The actual terminal operations is done by other terminal operators. So in the vision of Johor Port Authority, they want to have a consistent halal communication on freight documents in IT system and on containers, but also consistent handling practices. Because there are many different terminal operators and many different logistics service providers, so they don't want that every terminal operator has different practices, because then you get differences in the halal assurance system and halal freight systems for a country as Malaysia, which is an Islamic country. So you want to have consensus. You want to have one model as one country. So I was very privileged to assist the Malaysian government to develop a halal port supply chain policy, and we did it together with the operators. So we had terminal operators involved, halal authorities involved, we had shipping lines involved, and the top shipping lines of the world involved in this process. Also, logistics service providers were involved, container depot handlers, and even shippers. So we did it together with the industry. So it was carried by the industry. So that happened, the start happened last year in July 2019, started with a visit to the key terminal operators. In Malaysia, we have Port of Tanjung Pelepas, Johor Port, but also we have terminal operators for palm oil, quite a number. We had meetings with the religious authorities, the Islamic Religious Department of the State of Johor in South Malaysia, also the National Halal Authority, JAKIM. And then we had a first industry workshop to determine what are the halal control points and control measures in halal ports and halal terminal operations. Then we had other meetings again, face to face, with the terminal operators, and we had a review meeting with the Halal Authority to get a feedback on, is this allowable what we do in terms of our halal port operation? And based on their feedback, we had another session to share the more or less the draft final copy based on the recommendations of the Halal Authority. After that workshop, we finalized it, and together with the terminal operators, we worked on an implementation plan to implement the halal ports in Malaysia. We're currently doing readiness checks with the key terminal operators, and we hope to launch it by the 1st of January this year, of coming year. It's good to realize in Malaysia that halal certification is voluntary, it's not mandatory. So we are starting it slow, the implementation. We're starting with exports first and also looking at the ritual cleansing in the port operations. There's also already shipping lines offering already halal logistics, halal container services. This is CMA CGM. And what they have done, they have halal containers. So when you have a halal shipment, you can say this is only halal in this container. So they say from Malaysia to the Dubai, this container will be used for halal only. They will do ritual cleansing of that container and then also do a sealing of the container, a special seal, and also put a sticker on that container to identify that the container is halal. So it also comes with a certificate. It is a certificate of ritual cleansing of that container. So you see that the big shipping line like CMA, CGM is already offering halal container services. So therefore also important that the ports are looking at their role as well in halal supply chain. I do a lot of work in Indonesia. I was advisor to IPC Logistics Services. They are part of the Pelindo Group. And you might know that Pelindo is the owner of all the ports and terminals in Indonesia. And we developed in the port of Tanjung Priok, which is the main gateway for Indonesia. We developed a halal hub port and logistics services, focusing on storage, container transport to the other parts of Indonesia, and also domestic transport on Java. And what you see in the right corner, right bottom corner, you see a sticker on that container with the words halal supply chain and also the logo of the company IPC Logistics below that. Currently in Indonesia, I'm also developing a halal food cluster that's on the island of Java, 1 hour west of Jakarta, where we're developing a 500 hectare halal industrial and logistics zone. It also has a dry port to connect this halal cluster to the port of Tanjung Priok, the main sea gateway for Indonesia. It has a big logistics zone with also cool centers to do storage and distribution for the parties in here, but also as a national distribution center for Indonesia. In this halal park, we also have a commercial center and halal labs. So the national labs for Indonesia will be based in this park. A very exciting development, and certainly is worthwhile to note that the Indonesian government has a policy to develop Indonesia as a global halal production hub. So there are a lot of opportunities to look at Indonesia for import, export, and also to locate yourself in this global halal hub. Indonesia is the largest halal market of the world, also the largest Muslim country and a fast growing middle class. So it's exciting to be part of this. Finally, I would like to go into Europe. So Eurofrigo, based in the port of Rotterdam, was one of the pioneers, I must say, on halal logistics. They have a dedicated halal infrastructure called Room Infrastructure in the port of Rotterdam. And they are also market leader on board inspection for veterinarian products. So they do all those tests for the entire Europe. They are HALAL certified already for many years, and they also facilitate end-to-end HALAL supply chains from South America into the EU, and also from the EU into Asia. And they work with their other partners because they're part of Nichirai Logistics. So they have a global network of cold room infrastructure and also HALAL supply chain services. In Europe, we also had other initiatives over the past year. So the port of Algeciras in Spain is HALAL certified already for some time. Port of Zeebrugge in Belgium was one of the earlier ports had to develop HALAL cool chain services. So Europe has been very early, in fact, in terms of HALAL ports. Operations and HALAL distribution. So to round off, I would like to share with you some important conclusions, I think. I think it's good to realize that the HALAL industry is a big and dynamic industry. HALAL logistics and supply chain management are important emerging requirements for ports and shipping to address. It looks like that HALAL ports and also shipping have being a kind of missing link in end-to-end HALAL supply chains. So it's good if you want to be part of that HALAL cool chain programs all over the world, part of those cool chains to the Middle East and Asia. It's important to prepare yourself for this. It is a big market, and I think there's also an opportunity to earn income out of this trade and work together, I think, with the best. This was my presentation. Thank you so much. And if you have any questions, let me know. I've been working on a book on HALAL business management. It should be available this December, and it will also cover a lot about HALAL ports, HALAL logistics, and HALAL cluster development. So that should be available in your bookshop. Thank you so much. I look forward for your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Marco. Talking about a double-digit growth market at a time when the world is challenged economically, surely must present many exciting development opportunities, and fascinating in particular to look at the modern HALAL Valley development, bringing lots of elements together. We're going to move on now to our final presentation, which is also another growth market where lots of development is taking place. We move to the Middle East, and I'll ask Sophie to talk a bit about cold chain logistics developments in the GCC region. So Sophie, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It was also great to hear the presentations from Alfred and Marco, both known to me for a long time. Super happy and delighted to be a part of this great network again and see so many familiar faces. Today I greet you all from my home in the Sultanate of Oman. Outside it's 33 degrees, nice and sunny, but of course also here we still face restrictions. So working from home is daily reality, and also we are now again in an evening lockdown. So yeah, we are hoping for better times around the world soon. Yeah, so today, again, very happy to be here. I will briefly update you on the developments and challenges in this part of the world. So for me personally, I will touch upon Oman most of the time, but I will try to also do that in the bigger region of the GCC. So let's start. Oh yeah, I'll click myself, sorry. To introduce you a little bit more on Oman. Oman is situated on the south end of the Arabian Peninsula. It's a very pleasant and peaceful and political stable country. So even in times of today, Oman is still in good trade relations with all the countries around. And also keeps trading with sanctioned countries such as Qatar and also Iran. Oman is part of the Gulf Cooperation Council since 1981, together with the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain. The GCC, actually, the full region, has over 60 million consumers. And also what you should realize, I think very relevant for the discussion in this conference, is that the GCC has a huge dependency on food imports. So for some of these countries, it's over 60 to 70% of food that needs to be imported from abroad. Looking at the Oman location, I don't know if you see Sohar very clearly on the map. Also going into the port industry a little bit further, Oman actually has three main ports. So there's the transshipment hub Salalah in the south. There's a new port development called Duqm Port in the middle of the country. And there's the main port, Sohar Port and Free Zone in the north. So we are actually very strategically located just outside the Strait of Hormuz. It's a 2-hour drive to our capital city of Muscat and only like 3 hours to Dubai. And we also really are looking forward and opening direct connections to Saudi Arabia, which would make Riyadh accessible within 12 hours by road. So moving forward a little bit and taking a closer look at some statistics. So actually the GCC imported 55 million tons of food in 2019. This is the volume carried by ocean freight only. So this does not take into account what comes over the land borders or via air. In containers, it was about 1.9 million TEU, of which I estimated 40% would be reefer cargo. You can see here, definitely it's an import region because the export from GCC in 2019 was only 5.8 million tons. Actually, Oman is exporting quite a bit, mostly bakery products, edible oils, and fish. Of the total volume of food imports, cereals, grains, and wheats represent more than half of the volume. Of course, this is mostly shipped in bulk. Animal feed, vegetable, fruit, and sugars make the rest of the import top five. A lot of the other product categories, of course, are received by containers. The largest volumes are imported by Saudi Arabia, around 26 million tons. And after that, the United Arab Emirates with about 60 million tons. But Oman itself, for example, is a market importing 4 million tons yearly. And as said, we export also quite a bit. It's, of course, way less in percentage, but we're still a good exporter in the region. And actually, to explain further for Oman, we trade, our biggest trade partners for food would now be India. So I'm very keen to also hear the presentation this afternoon, and the UAE. And of course, from the UAE, we reach by sea, but it's also by land border. And Sohar is actually one of the main ports where food is coming into the country and actually serving the Oman market. And as a port authority, we're of course very keen to attract more food into a food vibrant food cluster we have right now. To shortly also introduce you, by the way, I forgot that a little bit, the Sohar Port and Free Zone itself. We are a young and growing, fast growing port in the Middle East, as I said, just outside the Strait of Hormuz. And what is actually interesting, it's 15 years old now, and it has been a development from the start in a JV set up between the Omani government and the Port of Rotterdam. That's why you would also see some of the Dutch people still hanging around in Oman and enjoying their time there. So moving forward, actually looking into trends and developments in the GCC. Food sales in the GCC are for 70% through retail. So in the UAE, the retail market is quite developed, but in the other GCC countries, There are a few large hypermarkets, but the sector is mainly dominated by many small local players. So it is expected that consolidation will take place, and also that the hypermarkets will grow their dominant position. So to give an example, in the UAE and Oman, we have big hypermarkets like Lulu, but also Carrefour. They are active in the whole GCC region, and they would have local operators that will do their distribution and warehousing for them. Online sales is actually quite limited still in the GCC. Of course, home delivery is picking up, and I think this pandemic made a big change in how this market will grow in the future. And definitely we saw in Oman, I think the online services and online food services growing very fastly. Talking about the pandemic, I think it made very clear again in this region that the GCC very much depends on imports of food, but definitely also pharma. So where it's 70% of food imports for most of the countries, for pharma it's even higher, it's over 90-95%. This makes all the states in the GCC quite keen on reducing this dependency. So we see that the GCC states do that actually in three different ways. First of all, through national reserves programs. So to give you an example, during the pandemic, the UAE actually was referring to their state food security law and assured all its citizens that they had food stock via retailers available for the UAE citizens for 6 months at least, for reasonable prices. So they actually bring it like this. This is our food reserve for 6 months. And I think maybe during the pandemic, aside from food, they might have added toilet paper to the mix. But maybe another development we see is actually national food production projects. So GCC state governments are stimulating, starting, and financing various food production projects. And in Oman, I have a few very clear examples. First of all, we have a good import volume in Oman from BRF Sadia Group for our frozen and fresh poultry products. But a few years ago, the Omani government, through an Oman food investment company body, started to also produce poultry within the country and sell poultry for a good price to its local citizens through Asafa. Same was actually for dairy. So Almarai is one of the biggest dairy groups in the GCC region, coming from Saudi Arabia, had a very strong position in dairy in Oman. But this year, the Omani government, through Oman Food Investment Company, launched the Mazoon Dairy Farm. So they imported livestock, brought it to the greenest region we have so far, and started producing dairy and yogurt products, so milk and yogurt products for the Omani market. So you can see here how projects are initiated to decrease the dependency on imports and other regions. One final example is also that we see a growing interest in industrial and vertical farming. So where now, if I go to the supermarket, I buy a lot of the green leaf, specialist green vegetables, for example, from a Dutch company called Leefaart that supplies the supermarket by air. The GCC states want to reduce actually and rely also a little bit more on local sourcing. So one of the examples that started this year is Madar Farms in Abu Dhabi, in partnership actually with the Dutch greenhouse technology, to supply the local market with fresh green vegetables. Overall, so rising food demand, government focus on food security and retail consolidation drive investment in the food sector in the GCC. An increase in distribution and cold storage is actually needed. The GCC cold chain segment has significant potential due to a growing market and also quite limited competition so far. It will require substantial capital investment though, and there are only a few third-party food logistics providers at this very moment. And I can tell you, especially Oman is still looking at weak cold chain infrastructure. So from all the GCC states, you see that throughout these countries, the weak cold chain infrastructure is still seen, resulting, of course, in a lot of wastage of food, but also high costs of products. And some examples actually from Oman, and that is from myself as a very demanding consumer, always looking for fresh and good food. Some things that I actually encounter myself going into the supermarket in Oman, and then some things that also really annoy me actually, is packaging failures in Oman that would be use of excessive plastic, but also already molded berries, blueberries that you buy in the high-priced import section. Frost burn on your ice cream package as soon as you buy it, unavailability of certain products, and also clearly can see if you unpack it that a frozen product was defrosted and then refrosted again. So these are daily issues that we still have in Oman. So enough room for development actually. And also enough room, of course, to come and invest in Sohar. So actually in Sohar Port and Free Zone, we have the food trade already in place. So we have Hutchison Container Port receiving all containers, and we have a dedicated agri-bulk berth receiving all the agri-bulk. We have main food processing facilities also available in our port already, such as the flour mill, but also now a sugar refinery and an oilseed crushing plant coming up. I'm also very, very pleased to announce, and I'm happy I can use this platform for that, our first state-of-the-art cold store will open by the end of this year in our free zone. So our very respected client, Alhossen Warehousing and Logistic, will open the cold store towards the end of the year with 2,400 square meters of cold storage with, say, 20 units, temperature ranges between plus 10 and minus 20 available for rent. And our client Alhossen is here in the audience. You can reach out to them via me to require more information, please. To end my presentation, actually, Sohar is welcoming much more food activities, be it in trade. So we see we want to increase the ease also of bringing more Indian vegetables into Oman. Also, we are still keen to have a direct Europe connection, so reduce the number of products that need to go by air. I clearly see potential from East Africa. I'm very keen to also hear the next session this afternoon and to stay connected. There are clearly opportunities for food production, especially in the processed foods, fish processing, as I said, oilseed crushing, and virtual farming. Of course, the cold chain and the food logistics services. So to just finalize my presentation, I want to welcome you all very warmly to the beautiful country of Oman. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Sophie. Fascinating presentation, both from a business context and the personal observations of someone living in the country who's very well educated in cold chain and the things you can see are happening or not happening that you would like to. I've just been informed that we actually can extend our question time and discussion time, which I'm really pleased about because such a lot of content, thank you, delivered by the panel this morning. Struck by the focus on growth opportunities and investment opportunities. We've got a number of questions coming in, but just to kick off, Sophie, I wanted to ask you, as you concluded your presentation, you briefly touched on connections from East Africa and Europe. And in the next session, we are going to be talking about East Africa from an export earning market potential. Could you talk a little bit more about, what's the current situation on connectivity and what you'd like to see for the future to connect the market?
Yes, Rachel, thank you for the question. We see now ports of Sahara is actually very well connected to the GCC market itself, to India, to Pakistan, very direct connections. We even have a very good direct connections to Singapore, so also reaching Southeast Asia. Personally, and also on the agenda for a port for a long time, and more on the wish list, is more of a direct connection to Europe. So a lot of the European volume now goes via Salalah or via Jebel Ali in Dubai, and then gets to us. So we hope to grow the volume via Europe and also have a direct connection there. And the second thing is indeed what we talked about, East Africa. If we see the export potential of these countries grow, and especially in the fresh produce, I think the Middle East would be such an interesting market for them also to start. As you could see, we are importing a lot of vegetable and fruits. We are keen to have other sourcing areas. We have enough consumers. They get more sensitive for healthy foods. And I think the distance would be interesting to cross. Of course, you need the right equipment, the right shipping conditions, and also the right logistics suppliers. But we are especially very keen in Oman to receive new volumes from East Africa for sure.
Well, certainly, Sophie, thank you. The points you made with regard to food security, which we've been discussing the last few days, and the region's dependency on imports, both for food and pharma. So, yes, thank you for that. That actually ties in with, and excuse me a second, a question that had come in for you, Sophie. So I shall ask that from Andy Cannell. Says hello. So for Sophie, he says, would you recommend that Sohar is a better option to land truck to Dubai than by sea in a hurry, if in a hurry with cargo?
Dear Andy, thanks for your question. It was very good to see you again. We were in touch earlier. I always had good to touch upon friends in South Africa again. I was definitely, of course, if you ask me, I say yes. But I would consider Oman as an interesting, and especially in Sohar, as an interesting alternative to Dubai, in that sense that it probably has shorter sailing time because you're not entering the Strait of Hormuz. Oman is, again, as said, a very politically stable and very peaceful country, not fighting with anybody. And simply from Sohar, you can drive into the UAE within an hour. So the border is within an hour reach. Dubai is 3-hour drive. Abu Dhabi is a little bit further, 4-hour drive. And maybe to explain further, similar to the European Union, if you enter Oman, you enter the GCC. A lot of the food products are actually not charged, not taxed. But if it's taxed, you only be taxed once. So if you enter Oman, you can enter the GCC market from there. And especially if you want to reach Saudi Arabia, I think we're going to be very competitive there, especially if the road also opens.
So I have a question for Sophie and Marco, and Alfred may wish to comment as well. Sophie, also towards the end of your presentation, something Marco talked about too, was the investment angle, because obviously it's not cheap to put up these big new infrastructure projects. And now we're in a period of lockdown where perhaps normal business development practices and engagement is not possible. People can't travel to meet and get together in person in the same way. So really just a question for, yes, Sophie and Marco, Alfred, what's the investment climate like at the moment? And, what do you think going forwards in our new kind of new normal? How's capital going to be raised? How's the investment going to be secured?
Can I say first? In fact, the economy is very bad in Japan as well as other areas. So the government is looking forward to actually subsidies and investments. And also, if you have a good kind of a service, a product, or a kind of technology, basically it's easier to get the funding from the market right now because they're looking forward to injecting money to help the economy. So I believe that anything new, anything that can bring the so-called economy to a better level will be welcome, including support infrastructure, including the river technology, the coal supply chain, and also the coal storage. I can see that there is a shortage of river boxes right now. And you can also understand that in China, maybe the production this year may not be sufficient enough to meet the market demand, as CIMC already make known the numbers. So I believe that more investment on river boxes as well as river circle will be something quite promising and optimistic.
We have in the UK also, plans to stimulate infrastructure investment because of the economic downturn. So there's a clear analogy there in terms of the role of the government versus private sector. So Marco, if I can ask you, where's the investment coming from for the large scale projects you've been talking about? Private, public sector, and what's the climate for investment?
Well, if I talk about Southeast Asia, I think there has been a shortage of cold chain infrastructure. So what you see now, like in Indonesia on the Java Island, there is some cold chain infrastructure. Outside Java Island, there's very little. So there, I think there's a need for cold chain infrastructure is based on new technology. We have a lot use old technology. We have a lot of small size cold infrastructure, so we need to develop a new generation of big size cool reefer centers. And then we have to use solar energy. I'm here similar in the Middle East, Sophie, you have very hot temperatures there. So it is beautiful to harvest the sun energy and apparently the energy in South Asia has been too cheap with the oil. So it's now time also to leverage and harvest the sun energy. I think the appetite for investment is good in South Asia because we were so behind in terms of cold chain infrastructure. If you talk about halal, there are a new wind blowing. Indonesian government wants to become a global halal hub. The Indonesian government made massive improvements in terms of investment of road infrastructure, connecting cities together via road, connecting cities together via railway. High speed railways are being planned. So this is a new dimension. In Islamic in the halal industry, there's Islamic banking and finance. So there's a lot of money in the Islamic banks. So it is a very positive buzz, a very positive environment here regarding investments, definitely.
Thank you, Marco. And that interesting extra dimension in terms of government investment in the connecting infrastructure, not just the node, but as we're talking about today, the modes that connect in and out. So Sophie, could I ask you to give a view on the sort of investments climate, public and private sector, and what you see in your part of the world?
Of course, Rachel. Yeah, as I explained, we were very happy to see at least the first investment in the cold store planned as it was. So no delays there. And that is also because we believe this market is growing still. So the cold storage is finalized this year by a big investment group. It's an Omani Qatari group, Al-Hussein, in Oman. We've seen actually quite some interest within the region to invest. So maybe the international new business development has dried up a little bit, at least in meeting face to face and also showing them the possibilities here physically. But we do still see interest in investment from within the region. And also, I have to emphasize, I think, for example, in Oman, the government is very keen to at least support investment and also help in any way to smoothen the start of business in our country. We have a whole new set of ministers here in Oman since this year, and very keen to attract more investment and very ready to reach out and make things easier in terms of doing business. So that is quite positive. And we touched upon connectivity a little bit. I think that is also something that still keeps going. And also we try to improve connectivity very much. I was just informed by my CEO actually, by WhatsApp secretly, that we also have a direct connection to Iraq at this moment, and also really improved sea cargo flows within the region and also with Saudi Arabia under the TIR agreement. So you can see that this pandemic is also a moment in time to improve both the business climate and also the connectivity.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Sophie. We've got a number of questions in, so I want to make sure that we get to field them. Question in for Alfred from Bharadwaj Bhuyan. I've got quite a few from him. Thank you for the activity this morning. So Alfred Sam, as usual, a very insightful presentation. Besides Japan Rail, do you see any potential to use the Hyakan reefer in other long distance rail transport, such as China-Europe rail, in the near future? Essentially, I believe it's trying to replace truck under transport. Hence, there could be some opportunities here again.
Yes, I think so, because right now this is only a pilot study. And in fact, the Hyakan reefer boxes have been in Japan for a while. And actually, it's also something not new in Vietnam too. This technology actually applying to rail is the first time in Japan for the JR cargo, JR rail cargo. And I believe that with the improvement in reducing the weight and also improvement in the battery, lithium battery, and it can be used for other rail systems in Europe or in Eurasia, and also for trucks as well as for moving around in the model. So I think it's only a matter of time. And in fact, if you ask the manufacturer like CIMC, they may probably be interested in looking further into building these boxes, Hyakan boxes, for rail or for even for sea freight. Actually, there is some river boxes with the Hyakan system for the ocean-going river box too at this moment.
Ah, thank you for that, Alfred, because you've answered Bharadwaj's second question, which was, are there any plans to use this technology in the marine container sector? So that looks like it's a yes, for sure.
Yes.
Let me just check our question stream. And another one from Bharadwaj, but for this time again for Sophie. Does SOHAR allow in-transit coal treatment?
Interesting question. Thanks for that. I'm not sure if I know exactly what that means. I presume that you...
There's a little extra here that might give some more context. Oh. Apologies. Does SOHAR allow transit coal treatment in case of blueberries, for example, or CT products? Or do these products need to complete the process and be certified before arrival? So I guess this is around, products generally requiring coal treatment.
Very good question, actually. I'm not sure if I can answer that completely without also having to refer to the practices in our container terminal from Hutchison and also customs.
Yes.
Hutchison has the river plugs facilities, and customs is present there. But I assume this is a question to see if it's from Oman can also be in transit onward transport to other countries, I guess. Let me promise to get back to this more specialized question separately, if you don't mind, because I don't want to say anything that is not true. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophie. Coming back, Brid, and for the panel in general, you know, and thinking about Marco and the halal market, you know, halal market is so big and growing. Question for Marco, you know, Alfred's touched on e-commerce, you know, and the growth in last mile delivery, not least generated by the pandemic. Is there a last mile e-commerce halal market also emerging?
Yeah, so there are different halal portals, e-commerce portals have been created over the past years, in particular Asia. And the last mile is very important because traditionally in the last mile, the logistics service providers like to consolidate in order to make a living, you know, put all the products together. And there is halal, you don't want that. You don't want mixing of halal and non-halal, in particular if this goes to Islamic countries. So that's important. So in a lot of Muslim countries, there have been halal certification of logistics service providers. It was earlier the local players, and now you see companies like DB Schenker, halal certified, DHL, and there are other players also from Japan, halal certified. So it's going mainstream, and that is, I think, exciting. We're not there yet, so still a lot of logistics companies are not halal certified, but there's definitely a potential for growth and need. Because we had seen over the past year many cases of halal issues, halal crises that went berserk on the media, and companies lost millions of US dollar in terms of reputation damages and sales. So it's an important matter, and for big brand owners, they put this in contracts with a logistics service provider. And in fact, we did a halal project in cosmetics for a big multinational. And we asked the logistics service providers operating the national DC in Indonesia, you have two options, get halal certified or get out. So he was certified a few months later.
Thank you, Marco. So, Alfred, you know, you raised in brief a very large issue around the e-commerce, last mile delivery, as you said, working from home, eating from home, which is the big topic here. So, you know, thinking about your views on last mile, you know, how much is the digital transformation tied in with development of the last mile?
In the last mile food delivery, actually, there are lots of platforms and also apps. Actually, you can order online using apps, and then they have everything set for you. And there will be a special team for delivery, like Uber Eats and so on and so on. And in fact, you can change your order. Say, for example, all of a sudden you want to delay 15 minutes, and then they can take care of that and become very flexible and very sophisticated. And I believe this is the so-called last kilo or last mile delivery. And in the days to come, it will become a big business because people are working from home, even though for office, there will be only a few people there, and they can't go out to eat it, they have to order. And again, in order to have the economy rebuild again, then this kind of so-called actually for lunchtime, dinner time, and gathering, and also maybe virtual gathering, for example, like a delivery whiskey to London and also delivery to me in Tokyo at the same time, maybe. And this will be a kind of so-called business opportunity in the days to come. And also for halal, I think that's important, and because there are lots of Muslim people living around the world. And it's quite easy, you know, you have the delivery mechanism geared towards the HALA procedures. And I think this is something, another business opportunity for the days to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think the whole session has, you know, we could definitely have a whole conference. Many conferences are on the last mile. I am looking conscious of the time, but the question I might kind of just throw out, not a rhetorical question, is about the influence that the last mile is going to have back up the chain to the middle mile in terms of how infrastructure is developed and delivered to cater for e-commerce. We were talking yesterday about Amazon, for example, and its movement into logistics and transport. Perhaps that's something we can talk more about as the day goes on. But I would say what I've heard this morning, which is exciting, you know, and the last few days, is this is a market with lots of potential generally, globally. But we've talked e-commerce and halal and GCC markets where there is potential for growth and revenue. Many challenges, but a positive message to come out. I can see, I think we have one last question and we have about 4 minutes. So I'm going to pose it out just for us to close. And I think it's a message for Sophie. The question is from Vijan Chetty, PPECB, South Africa, asking what is the biggest challenge experienced by the port?
I think, I don't know if I talk about the full port in that sense, but I would say in our region, we still face so many cold chain elements. So it is not a cold chain that is very efficient. There's so much handling, there's so much disruptive temperature, there's so much different players involved, the one more experienced than the other. So I would say for us as a port, we want to aim at getting this cold chain better. So improve it, getting it more efficient, faster, and safer. So less disruptions. I would say that is our biggest challenge. And for that, we still need some investment and also some parties to join us, definitely in Oman.
Thank you, Sophie. Well, one of the things we didn't get chance to get into, but we will do in the next session, is that physical and digital and what digitalization may be able to do to assist processes and address some of the issues that you're mentioning. So hopefully you can rejoin us in the audience for the next session and maybe make some comments as well. So without further ado, I just want to thank you all, panel, for starting our day off in such fine fashion with such interesting presentations. Thank you, audience, for being online and for asking questions. I hope you have enjoyed the session. We are taking a short break now, but do head on over appropriately to our sponsor session for Asia Fruit Logistica, who have supported us for many years. Thank you very much. So go on over and find out a bit more about what's happening at that major trade event taking place virtually this year in a short while. We'll be back for the next session to continue the discussion on new markets, and we'll be looking at East Africa and Latin American markets. So thank you and see you soon.